Hi, I'm Ashley Gallagher from Pharmacy Times, and you're listening to Pharmacy Focus. The Pharmacy Times Pharmacy Focus podcast provides the latest industry news and information, thought leader insight, clinical updates, patient counseling tools, and innovative solutions for the everyday practice and business of pharmacy. On this month's episode, we spoke with Lucas Morgan, a partner at Fryer Levitt, about how to navigate the Board of Pharmacy as a pharmacist. Can you give listeners just kind of a brief overview of the relationship between the boards of pharmacy, pharmacies, and other third parties, which can include payers, PBMs, federal government, and CMS?
I would describe the relationship between a state board of pharmacy, a pharmacy, and third-party payers as being triangular in nature, in the sense that they all kind of work together with one another to ensure that they're all apprised of the different information that would be available from one to the other. Pharmacies obviously have to be able to do business in their state, need to be licensed with their board of pharmacy. So that's kind of as a threshold matter. They're going to have to be able to obtain a license from their state board of pharmacy and usually any other states in which they intend to do business in. In addition, as a practical reality, you're also going to have to be able to obtain access into the major payer networks. Those could be a government-based payer network at either the state or federal level, or it could be a private payer network that's overseen and managed by a private company like a pharmacy benefit manager or a PBM. The three largest PBMs are Caremark, Express Scripts, and OptumRx. And I think where you kind of complete the triangle in that relationship is that while a pharmacy needs to have access to the PBM networks and also needs to have licensure from the State Board of Pharmacy where they're based, the PBM is also going to do some basic due diligence by relying on some of the information that's provided to the State Board of Pharmacy to ensure that they're letting reputable, reliable providers into their networks. And at the same time, State Board of Pharmacies and fulfilling their duty and mission to protect the health and well-being of the citizens and residents of their states may also work with PBMs to see if there's anything a PBM has learned about that would be a cause for concern for them. And I would say that we do see kind of a mutual type of communication between payers and state boards of pharmacy. And I would say that goes both directions.
What are some of the common actions that are taken by the boards of pharmacy?
Generally speaking, I think you're going to see state boards of pharmacy engage in some more general actions that might be issuing licenses, conducting inspections, that might be to approve a license or approve some sort of a change in the operation. It might be a change of location. And they also conduct investigations. As far as actions, in the disciplinary sense of the term, some of the bases that we see being relatively common in the sense that they frequently occur are pursuing actions based on allegations that a pharmacy failed to operate. And so this would arise in a circumstance where a pharmacy obtains its license, but pursuant to that state's rules and regulations, once they obtain that license, they're kind of on the clock, so to speak, to officially open and operate the business. The idea is boards of pharmacy do not want to be issuing pharmacy licenses to entities that don't intend to open in a relatively short time period. So that would be one issue. And what a, you know, what a board would look at is this pharmacy received its license on January 1st, 2023. It's now July 1st, 2023. The pharmacy does not appear to be doing any business. What's going on here? That can be a common basis for discipline. A second example of a common action would be some sort of a failure to provide a board of pharmacy with a requisite notice. This could be a notice of a change in hours. It could be a change in personnel. Commonly, a pharmacist in charge is a significant one. A pharmacy definitely has a duty and obligation in almost every state to notify boards of pharmacy if they've changed their pharmacist in charge. And a failure to do that is a common action that we see. And I would also add that typically, that is based on what I would describe usually oversight as opposed to some sort of a knowing and intentional withholding of information. And then a final example of a common action, although this is not an exhaustive list, but would be some sort of a failure to provide adequate supervision of pharmacy personnel. And kind of one little caveat to that is we often see that arise in what I would describe as kind of accidental circumstances. You know, it could be, and this is just a made up hypothetical, but perhaps there's a shift change and one or two pharmacy technicians report at a time period and they show up 10 or 15 minutes early for their shift. Meanwhile, two or three other pharmacy technicians are finishing out the last 10 to 15 minutes of their shift. And lo and behold, a pharmacy inspector or investigator arrives for something completely unrelated, but happens to realize that at that particular time, the pharmacist in charge was supervising three, four, or five pharmacy technicians. And perhaps that state has a ratio threshold of 1 to 2 or 1 to 4. So you can see how that could kind of be done mistakenly as opposed to intentionally. But that is something we see as a common basis for disciplinary action by a board.
What are some of the common oversights or mistakes pharmacies make that can lead to some of these actions?
So there's two general categories of oversights or mistakes that I see. One of them is just a general lack of awareness of certain rules and obligations that govern a pharmacy or a pharmacist in their particular state. And this is just the idea that a lot of times, you know, there's a lot of very specific detailed rules that a pharmacy must follow. You know, I spoke earlier about the idea of when you obtain your license, in many states, you're kind of on the clock, so to speak, to open the pharmacy within a certain specified time period. Many people aren't aware of this because they wouldn't think it's an issue if they're not open by a certain date. The other common mistake that I see is a belief, albeit a mistaken belief, that they will be excused from any wrongdoing that can be attributed to justifiable error. Also, the idea of just being justifiable or justified based on the general lack of awareness that I just spoke of. But these aren't going to cut it. And, you know, the most common example of this is what I would describe as mitigating factors. Many people mistakenly believe that what we would describe as mitigating factors actually serve the role of exculpatory factors. The idea that, well, this issue arose because of something entirely out of my control. And so therefore, you know, you're going to dismiss this, right? Well, typically, unless these mitigating factors are extremely compelling, usually that's not going to be sufficient to justify a board of pharmacy entirely dismissing a case against a pharmacy or a pharmacist. Now, it may result in a softening on the type of discipline that's implemented, but it's usually not going to result in complete dismissal. And that's, you know, when we talk about mitigating factors, you know, the other type of factors we would look at are exculpatory factors. And that's the idea that you just have inaccurate information. You believe that I didn't open within 6 months, for example, but I actually did. I opened within 3 months, and here's what I can show you to prove that. That is providing information to the board that shows you actually didn't violate the rule or regulation as alleged by the board.
How do state boards of pharmacy help to contribute to patient safety?
So I think state boards of pharmacy probably play one of the most integral roles in protecting patient health, well-being, and safety throughout the country. And in fact, if you look at most of the state boards of pharmacy's missions, you will see that that is usually kind of the leading theme of the various state board of pharmacy's missions. And I think the way that they do that is by monitoring the different pharmacy providers in their state, as well as the individual licensed pharmacists, to look for any types of concerning trends. And those types of trends could range anywhere from patient safety in the truest sense of the word, the idea of making sure that pharmacies are engaged in the practice of pharmacy in a manner that complies with all rules and regulations related to how drugs are prepared, how they are stored, how are they dispensed, to ensure that patients are receiving medications that are, you know, quality,
working in the way they're intended to, no adverse interactions, and that they're being dispensed in an accurate manner. Another example of something they would look for are trends related to, you know, fraud or waste in the system. And, you know, for example, something we've seen gain increased or heightened scrutiny over the last several years is looking at pharmacies' marketing practices. Perhaps, you know, a pharmacy utilizing or engaging in some sort of telehealth or telemedicine. Those are things that have garnered more attention. To be clear, though, there's certainly a path forward where you can engage in certain marketing practices or in telehealth or telemedicine of some sort or in collaboration with qualified providers. And there's a way to do that that fully complies with applicable law. They're going to be looking for anything that doesn't comply with applicable law as it relates to those types of practices.
What are some tips for pharmacists to avoid discipline from their state board of pharmacy?
First and foremost, it's really just trying to gain as much knowledge as you can of your state board of pharmacy's rules and regulations. And sometimes this is just, the answer here is just good old fashioned taking the time to sit down and study the rules and regulations. It is absolutely time consuming. But that's how you become aware of some of these more esoteric laws that might, you know, have very detailed requirements and obligations. I would also add, they're not necessarily hard to comply with, but you have to be aware of them in order to comply. So one is just kind of tasking yourself with becoming knowledgeable and aware of the different rules and regulations governing your practice of pharmacy. A second thing would be, you know, I really recommend having qualified legal counsel to serve as a partner. And along with this, I would look at it as the idea of, you know, you want to focus more on being proactive and preventative in your approach to things, as opposed to reactive in dealing with problems once they arise. And the reason why I recommend having, you know, qualified legal counsel to kind of help navigate the Board of Pharmacy experience is because oftentimes people are reluctant to hire legal counsel because it can cost, you know, a significant amount of money. But what I would say is it's far more cost efficient and practical to work with a qualified professional in your industry to prevent issues than to have to hire them to solve a problem after it's already occurred. So that's part of that proactive. So again, make you become very knowledgeable, but also to the extent that you don't necessarily have the time to do that exclusively and entirely on your own, work with someone that can help you do that more effectively and more efficiently. And then the third thing I would recommend is engaging with your board of pharmacy and become as much as you can a familiar face to them. And you can do this by engaging through attending the board of pharmacy meetings. A lot of people are not aware of the fact that these are usually publicly held. To the extent you can travel to a meeting and appear in person, I think that's a good practice. And again, it's just for observational purposes only, and it's a good way to meet the Board of Pharmacy members. So that can be really helpful. Learning your Board of Pharmacy's mission. If you understand what they view their mission as, it's going to help inform how you or what role you as a pharmacist or a pharmacy play in helping the board to achieve their mission. And so it would help to kind of change the narrative, if you will, to having a relationship with the board of pharmacy where they view you as a partner in achieving their mission as opposed to someone they need to police. So those are the three main things I would start with, which is, you know, increase your personal knowledge, work with a qualified professional to help you, you know, where you need help. And the third would be engaged directly with your board of pharmacy as much as you can.
How can pharmacies build their relationship with the state boards of pharmacy, and why is this relationship important?
Yeah, I think that kind of relates to the third point I made. It's the idea of engaging with the board of pharmacy. Look for opportunities to interact with them. That's really going to help to build and establish a good, professional, positive relationship with the Board of Pharmacy. Another thing I would say on the topic of engaging is if you ever have a question, you should reach out to the Board of Pharmacy. Almost every Board of Pharmacy in the country maintains a very detailed database of what we would call frequently asked questions, which can be very informative, but they also tend to have personnel that are prepared to answer any questions you might have. And these usually can be presented through email or through phone. And I would say one recent trend I've noticed is I'm a big proponent of phone calls. And the reason being, I'm finding that a lot of personnel are inundated with emails every day. Sometimes a phone call can be a very quick way to get answers to questions because they have personnel there that are answering the phones, taking these questions, finding answers, and not a lot of people are making phone calls, but a lot of people are sending emails. And I think by engaging like that, you're documenting that interaction. So if at any point there were an issue, if you made a phone call, asked a question to a board of pharmacy representative, received some information, perhaps documented that with a follow-up email. Thank you so much for your time today. Thank you for addressing my question. I really appreciate you confirming that the following is the way I should go about addressing this issue. We will do that. Thank you again. If later it turns out that, you know, that wasn't really the solution, or perhaps it was the solution, but there's some question as to whether you followed through with that, you kind of have that documented so you could point back to it and say, hey, Board of Pharmacy investigator, inspector, keep in mind, I engaged with you on this. I reached out to you about this. At the bare minimum, that could serve as a really compelling mitigating factor, but depending on the circumstances, that type of engagement with the Board of Pharmacy could also serve as something that could vindicate you entirely in the context of a disciplinary action.
What are some recommendations for pharmacies once the Board of Pharmacy initiates an action? And is there a difference for disciplinary versus non-disciplinary?
So my first recommendation would really be, it's all about being responsive and communicative with the Board of Pharmacy. Oftentimes, there, I think there is a very natural inclination and human tendency to want to bury your head in the sand and hope that somehow this is going to go away. Believe it or not, I've often found that when confronted with Board of Pharmacy disciplinary action, some individuals mistakenly believe that no action can be taken against them if they do not engage. The mistaken belief would be, well, they can only act to my detriment if I contact them. And if I contact them, then they have free rein to kind of act accordingly. But if I avoid that contact, then they're really constrained. That could not be farther from the truth. You know, Board of Pharmacies, because they're an agency, have an ability to act in a very expeditious manner, especially in instances where people do not respond or try to rely on tactics of obstruction versus engagement. So rule number one, I always say, is be responsive, communicate with the board as it relates to a disciplinary action. Again, I can't do my job as an attorney if I do not highly recommend that you engage legal counsel. My hope is that if you are confronted with a disciplinary action, the need to involve an attorney will be limited, and hopefully they'll be able to work with you to find a way to bring it to a quick conclusion. But this is not the type of legal situation where you want to go it alone. Unless you happen to be an attorney in addition to being a pharmacy owner or a pharmacist, I really don't think it's the type of environment where you want to try to figure this out on your own. And one of the reasons for that is, as I just mentioned a moment ago, state boards of pharmacy are unique in that they are a state-based agency. And as a state-based agency, they have a substantial amount of discretion, and they're also given a substantial amount of deference as it relates to their authority to act. And so to make sure that you are kind of responding appropriately, not saying things that could be construed as an admission inadvertently, you really want to make sure you're navigating this with legal counsel working with you. And then, you know, the last thing I would say is you do, regardless of whether you make the choice to retain an attorney or not, you do want to approach this with an attitude of cooperation. Now, to be clear, cooperation does not mean that you just admit that you did something you didn't do, or it doesn't mean just admitting to everything. But it's the idea of engagement, and it kind of goes along with that idea of being responsive and communicative. Boards of pharmacy respect and appreciate pharmacy professionals who take the situation seriously, are communicative and cooperative. So that would be a final recommendation if you're faced with that. Now, as to whether there's a difference between disciplinary and non-disciplinary action, there absolutely is. But I would say non-disciplinary action is typically a result that is achieved in the context of something that was initiated as a disciplinary action, but because of information that was presented to the board during the process of the disciplinary action, they saw fit pursuant to their statutes, rules, and regulations governing the Board of Pharmacy to implement something that they consider to be non-disciplinary in nature. And I would say that that tends to be a very favorable result. One little caveat there is not all states provide for a non-disciplinary resolution to something that originates as disciplinary action, but there definitely is a difference. And if your state provides for that, you definitely want to see what you can do to try and achieve such a result.
Is there anything you want to add while we wrap up?
I would just really summarize with, I think the relationship that pharmacy professionals have with their state boards of pharmacy has been overlooked by many. And I think there's good reason for that. There's been a great deal of attention focused on trying to maintain and sustain relationships with payers, which can be a full-time job in and of itself. And I think one of the unintended consequences of that is that pharmacy professionals' relationships with boards of pharmacy hasn't gotten the attention it deserves. So I really would just strongly encourage to try and bring that back to the forefront for all pharmacy professionals, and it really can pay dividends if it's done right.
Thanks for listening to Pharmacy Focus. Stay tuned for our next episode, where we will be joined by another key opinion leader in the pharmacy space.